welcome to the Empire Podcast and this very special spoiler special podcast for The Last of Us Part 2, which is neither a movie nor a TV show, but rather a video game, making it the very first video game that we have deemed worthy of an Empire spoiler special podcast. However, this is no ordinary video game, as anyone, I think, who's played it can attest. So way back in 2013, when the original Last of Us came out, we were kind of floored by the quality of the storytelling in this game. I think more than any other game we'd ever played. So much so that we dubbed that the best film of the year that wasn't actually a film. And now 7 years on, developer Naughty Dog has kind of pulled off a similar feat with The Last of Us Part 2. And because of that, and not in any way because we all now exist in a post-outbreak wasteland where deadly clickers roam the aisles of Morrison's, we've decided to take the next hour or so to dive beneath the surface of the game, talk about its themes, its story beats, and its somewhat divisive impact on fans, all with a little help from director Neil Druckmann. Now, I can only assume that if you're listening to this, then you've already played through the game. And if that's not the case and you don't want it spoiled, then you should really stop listening now and go and fire up your PlayStation. This is a spoiler special podcast. There will be lots of plot twists revealed, lots of discussions of things that happen in the game. You have been warned. Now, as a special treat, I should point out this particular spoiler special is appearing on our main podcast feed and not behind the paywall where our spoiler special archive usually resides. However, if you do enjoy this and you find yourself desperate for more, then you can subscribe to the Empire Spoiler Special podcast at glow.fm/Empire Film, where for a nominal monthly fee, you'll get access to our entire archive going back to 2012, plus a bare minimum of 2 new spoiler special podcasts every month, spanning new releases and even retro spoiler specials of classic films. But we are not here today to talk about a classic film, but rather a sure-to-be classic game. I'm James Dyer, and joining me to talk all things Codiceps today are two colleagues of such lethal cunning that they've both cut a swath through post-apocalyptic Seattle, leaving a trail of bloody corpses in their wakes. First up, a man who, and this is absolutely true, upon reaching the Santa Barbara sequence of the game, immediately texted me with the words, "Now I have a silenced submachine gun. Ho, ho, ho." It's Amon Warman. How are you, Amon?
I am good. And yes, I did. Easily my favorite weapon of the game. Love it.
Well, look forward to New Game Plus when you can use it from the very beginning.
I know. Believe me, I've been playing it and I have. It's been a godsend.
Joining us also is a man who was taking his time savoring this game over weeks until I demanded he play it all of last weekend so he could finish it in time for this podcast and quite possibly broke him in the process. It's Nick the Semlin. Nick, have you recovered?
No, I mean, it's been less than 40 hours since I finished, so I could burst into tears at any second. It's been happening a lot.
Have that effect on people.
Yeah, my favorite weapon in this game is the flamethrower because it made me feel like Ripley, even though Ripley didn't do quite as much screaming while she was walking around.
Absolute true story, I didn't use the flamethrower at any point in the first game. In this one I did, I used it on the Rat King, which we'll talk about later. But in the first game, I'm one of those awful people where I'll hoard all the shit and never ever use it in case I need it later. And then the game ends and I've got a completely full inventory full of shit. So I never used a single explosive arrow in my first playthrough, not once.
You could have just blown up the farm, flamethrown the farm.
That's it. I should have killed Dina with it.
Killed the scarecrow.
No, but my New Game Plus, I'm addressing this and I'm unleashing my arsenal on really everyone. So that is good. So, okay, fine. Before we get into this discussion, before we jump into The Last of Us Part 2, let's have a brief talk about the first game, your memories of that and what your expectations were going into this one. Amon.
Yeah, the first game, it took me a while to actually play it. Like, I wasn't sort of part of the initial hype train for that. Like, I think one of the reasons why I was excited to get the PS4 is that it came with The Last of Us Remastered. Mm. That's when I finally played the game. I'd obviously, you know, heard about it. You know, Twitter was all abuzz. The hype was very real at that point. And it mostly lived up to it. The ending really hit me hard in the best of ways. It was very unexpected, but it was very, very good. So yeah, my expectations for The Last of Us 2 were very high because of it. All the trailers and the footage that had been released before the game looked really good. The visuals were amazing. The gameplay looked great. And I obviously could not expect where the story was go in this game, and that really there's been no game that I've played which has elicited the emotional reactions that The Last of Us 2 did. And I'm sure we're going to get into why later on, but yeah.
Yeah, so it's interesting that you came to this quite late. Nick and I discussed this last year and the year before. Every time this game got delayed or it failed to come out, or at E3, they didn't announce a release date for it, and we'd be like raging about it. And I think both of us said, and it's quite a bold thing to say, you know, for us, given that we are professional sort of film and TV critics, that we said at the time that, you know, keep your Star Wars, keep your Endgame, keep all of these various things. There was no single thing we were looking forward to more than The Last of Us Part 2. Obviously, it varied depending on the year, but there was a point where we'd be like, so this year, when this year started, I was like, The Last of Us Part 2 is my entertainment high point of this year. It is the thing I'm looking forward to most. Is that fair, Nick?
No, same for me. This is the entertainment event of the year, and it didn't disappoint, which is incredible, because my expectations were very high. But I think I just have total faith in Naughty Dog at this point. I love everything they've done, frankly. I believe the technical term is a Naughty Dogger. No, that is. I immediately retract that. But you know, I've played every Uncharted game multiple times. I've even played the sort of slightly shit PS Vita one, Golden Abyss. Yes. I played The Last of Us DLC Left Behind, where you basically wander around a shopping mall for 3 hours. I just think nobody does what they do. You know, Telltale Games. I know, James, you're not a massive fan of that, but I quite liked what they were doing with creating the worlds and the storytelling, especially their Walking Dead kind of games, and making you make uncomfortable choices, which is what happens in The Last of Us a lot. But I just think they're brilliant. Their world building, their sort of willingness to take risks with narratives, their characters, they're phenomenal. And this is their high point, which I don't say lightly. I think this game is incredible. But yeah, I played the first one 4 times.
Jeez.
And I'll play it again, because it's just an amazing ride.
Yeah, I'm with you 100%. The first game, I have many favorite games. I've been playing video games since 1980, before, in fact. So I have a long story history of playing basically all the games, and I have a number of favorites. I think of all of them, I think The Last of Us has been one. If people had said to me, what is the best game you've ever played? I would have said The Last of Us. And the reason I would have said that is not because it is, you know, groundbreaking gameplay, and not because it's technically amazing, although I think it's very solid in both those areas. But I think what The Last of Us did for me is it elevated interactive storytelling to a completely different level. Like, it, you become very aware of, I think John Carmack from id Software used to say, like, plot in video games is like plot in a porn film. Everyone expects it kind of needs to be there, but it's really not why you turn up, and no one's that bothered if it's good. And so many games take that, like the story just drives the action. And for the first time, I think, with The Last of Us, is that this was a game entirely about story. It was a storytelling work of art. And I think one of the reasons that it works so well is, unlike so many games, and I know, you know, whether it be open world or not, a lot of games give you choices, they give you agency. The Last of Us gave you none, and I think that was deliberate. They were like, this is a story we want to tell. This is how it plays out. You will enact this story for us, but have no illusions. This is the story we're telling, and these are the choices you will make. And they try to get you on board with the character, and they try and get you into the head of the character, so that even if the character does things you wouldn't, you understand that they're genuine choices for that character. And I think as a piece of storytelling, it is without peer in video games. And in terms of the emotions it elicits, like great art, whether it be film, TV, whatever it is, great art elicits an emotional response. And I have never felt the way The Last of Us made me feel. Like, it destroyed me. The kind of thing where you just stare, and I did it with 2 as well, you stare at the credits for however long they play out, just, and you can't stop thinking about this game. It goes round and round your head. It's in your head all the time. You can't get it out of your head. And there was just something about this. It was a masterfully told.
Well, right from the start, right? Like game. The prologue, that opening sequence in Austin.
Goodness.
Where it absolutely ends with, you know, you play as the daughter first, right? Yeah.
I mean, you do.
Flips. And so right from the start, they established they're going to flip perspectives. They're going to make you feel stuff, get attached to people, and then and when you say get attached to someone, you play as them, and you get for hours, and you get so attached, and then suddenly they rip that away from you, and it has a massive impact.
People talk about how, oh, it's a video game, you know, but it's like, no, because of the control, because you're interacting, because you become those characters. I would argue that the, you know, emotional connection you have to the story is much more intense because you're a part of it, and you're not just a bystander, you're not just witnessing it. And as you say, like, controlling Sarah during that prologue and then her dying in Joel's arms is just devastating, absolutely devastating. And to make you feel that much grief, that much trauma after having played a game for like 15 minutes, you know, it's like the beginning of Up. Do you know what I mean? Like to manipulate your emotions with so little time investment is incredible, an incredible piece of work.
And just the dialogue, the exposition, it's so well written that it never feels like they're spoon-feeding you information. It feels like it's coming out of character always. So when there are two of you walking around, you're having actually really entertaining conversations, but getting really attached to the characters, it's incredibly well done.
And as you mentioned, Left Behind, there's very little, I mean, there's some, but there's not a lot of action in Left Behind. You have the two different timelines in that DLC where she's wandering around the one mall fighting hunters and then wandering around the other mall with Riley. But those story beats, whether they're in the photo booth or telling jokes or throwing bricks at a car or playing on the carousel or going through that Halloween shop and trying on masks, those are as engaging, if not more so, than the actual action sequences. And that is no small thing either.
There's a phenomenal game series. If you like Last of Us, it hasn't got nearly as much action, but Life is Strange, I'm a massive fan of as well. And you play as a teenage girl in that in the original series of that. But that's really worth checking out. It's brilliantly done.
Yeah, it's also a very good game.
I was just going to say that decisions coming out of character is a very important point because, as you say, Naughty Dog, they take risks and they make you do things that you don't necessarily want to do. The only way that works is if the decisions don't come out of nowhere and if decisions are rooted in character. And that is what Last of Us and Last of Us 2 also does very well.
Yeah, 100%. Like, Joel does some fucking heinous shit in the first game. But even if you're like, oh, I'm not sure I'd do that. And a lot of people are like, you know what? I would do that in that extreme situation, but you believe by the end that Joel would have done it. Like you know Joel well enough. He's a more rounded character, and you know so much about his path and his past and how he's got to where he is. Because it's a redemption story, isn't it? He loses his daughter, he loses his humanity, everything about his life falls apart, and he spends 20 years sort of descending into this sort of spiral of darkness and becoming a frankly quite unpleasant person. And then he gets shackled with this girl who has to take her across America, and bit by bit she chips away at his armor, and he doesn't want to let her in. He's an asshole to her. He tries to push her away, tries to offload her onto his brother, and eventually she manages to get through to him, and he lets down his armor, and she's his way back. She brings him back to himself. He finds himself again, and then obviously once he's got her, he will do absolutely anything to keep her, and he won't let anything happen to her.
See, I just before this I went back and looked on YouTube and rewatched the kind of the ending of the original film, and it was I was kind of shocked because it was so different to my memory of it. In my memory, you're playing as Joel and you're being really heroic and, you know, saving her, but I went back and it's brutal. It's like he's shotgunning doctors who are like begging him not to. But because it's built up so because of the way the game builds up, that feels the right thing to do when you're there. But I was kind of shocked out of context, just going, wow, okay, that's really fucking... He looks like the villain, you know?
That speaks to the whole essence of this game, which we will get onto very, very soon. But the whole essence of this game is it's not the actions themselves, it's the way those actions are framed. And I think the message of this game, what it tries to teach you, is human beings can justify any action at all as long as they are kind of almost morally primed to do so. Given the right context, given the right excuse, given the right reasoning, they can do all kinds of heinous shit. Whether that be murdering doctors or whatever. But let's jump into The Last of Us Part 2, for that is what we're here to talk about. But before we wade in, let's hear from someone with a far better perspective than we have. I refer, of course, to Naughty Dog's Neil Druckmann, the co-creator of The Last of Us Part 1 and the director and co-writer of Part 2 alongside Hallie Gross. Neil stopped by the podcast to share some of the secrets behind the decisions he made while creating this game. So without further ado, let's hear from him. Neil, welcome to the Empire Podcast. Let's start right in the thick of it, I think, for this. So you put people through the ringer as they play this game, and it's something that starts very early on with the death of Joel, the character that we all kind of grew to love and inhabit during the first game. So I guess what I want to ask is, how early on did you decide to do that, and how hard was it to get the tone of that key sequence right?
Very early on. So as soon as we... there was some debate about whether we should make a sequel to The Last of Us because how special it was for fans, but more importantly for us, is how special it was for us, how much we love this character, these characters, the world, the story we told, and we didn't want to do anything that would tarnish it for ourselves. That was very important. And once we felt like we landed on a story that's ultimately about empathy, and it felt very important to us, that story from the get-go had Joel's death to set the wheels in motion for this revenge genre story that ultimately gets into much deeper stuff than just revenge. And then as far as getting the tone right, it's something we talked a lot about. And there's always like a few important scenes that you want to save for as late as possible to capture, because you want to make sure you have everything else set up right, because that will inform what you should do with that scene. So, for example, in the first game, Sarah's death was one of the last scenes that we captured. It was pretty late in production, because we wanted to make sure everything else was right before we kind of like hit that scene. And then here, Joel's death was one of those, like, it's just this thing that was kind of looming over us. It's like, when are we going to get it? How should we do it? We had all these different versions of it that we had played with and wrote, and eventually try to distill it down to like what's the bare essentials we need to evoke a certain feeling in the player that will mirror what Ellie feels to set you off on this journey. And it was like, whereas the first game, you know, we're really after like sadness and loss. And there is some of that later in the game, you know, when you're going through Joel's house and there's a grieving that's happening there. But yeah. In that moment when Joel is taken out, we want you to feel dread and disgust and anger. Those were what we were trying to evoke from the player.
Because it's not just a death scene, it's a torture scene as well. And I saw there was a concept art in there which had him missing a hand at one point. So I guess you must have gone back and forth on quite how far to take that.
Yeah, there were all sorts of different versions. There was just to take you into our gruesome mind, there was one version where when he turned his back to Abby, she stabbed him in the spine and twisted the blade and like severed his spine and had him drop.
Wow.
But it's just like some of it just felt like unnecessary. Yeah. So it was like, what's the right amount? And even like when you're there, we don't show you the torture, right? We show you like kind of the aftermath of it. And even with the final blow, we're not fixating on it because it's like the gore of it is not important.
Mm.
Some of that is important. Why we flashed that imagery for Ellie as part of her PTSD. So it was important to show it for that, but we didn't want to make it titillating or torture porn. We were very conscious. Understand me, that doesn't work for everybody. Like for some people, this crossed the line, it was too much. But our intention was to just make it disgusting enough for you to put you in the mindset of Ellie.
Yeah, because it's important, because that horror aspect is kind of key to the theme of the game and understanding the place that it takes her to. You know, when I played it, I never felt it was gratuitous, but I felt it was enough that it triggered something emotionally, which I guess was the intention.
Yeah, and part of it is just, you know, how, for good or bad, how desensitized we are to Hollywood violence, which made for us to evoke those emotions, we had to take it to a very real, authentic place with the violence in order to motivate Ellie's action, which become darker and darker as she heads into the story. And she feels like she needs to get more closer to that concept of an eye for an eye for her to feel like justice has been served.
Because I think, as has been said before, the first game kind of had its core is this relationship, this sort of love relationship. And this is very much a game about hate. And I think my thought when I was playing this is one of the most adult video games I've ever played. And not because it's violent or because of the subject matter, but it has an emotional maturity that I think you don't see that often. And not just in gaming, I think across the board. So it asks quite a lot of the people playing it in terms of sort of moral nuance and empathetic flexibility. Was there a part of you making this that was worried that people would struggle to make that leap, that they might find that difficult?
Yes. And there was a similar feeling when we were making the first Last of Us coming off Uncharted. You know, Uncharted is pulpy action adventure. There are clear good guys and clear bad guys. And then we try to find nuance within that. But it's a simpler world in that respect. With The Last of Us, we're dealing more with grays and more subtext, less dialogue, and there's a lot to infer and interpret. And because of that, we were worried that it's going to go over a lot of players' heads and it wouldn't be as successful as Uncharted because of it. But we stuck to our guns and said, you know, this is the story we want to tell. Whatever happens, happens. And we found that, you know, we underestimated our players. Like, they got it. Like, so many people understood what it was after. And then we're like, okay, can we take it further? Can we make a story that's... Because even with the first game, Joel, the Joel's journey is a heroic one, even though has a checkered past, and you don't really feel what this guy is capable of until the very end, when you see him torture people and you see him kill people in cold blood to protect his daughter. So the whole exploration of that is to say, it's a journey of love, really, for both games. And both games are showing the beauty, the compassion that can come from love, and the horror and atrocities that could be committed in the name of love. Mm. So this game, we say, okay, we're not going to put you on the same journey. We're going to, that moral divergence is going to happen earlier on. And we're asking you to walk in these characters' shoes who are not going to be morally aligned with you because they don't live in your world, in your comfort. They have to deal with a lawless world where someone has done them violently mistreated someone they love. And this is how they try to correct that. And they make sometimes altruistic choices and often awful choices, but they're humans. It all coming from a place of love.
And it rejects the idea, I guess, that kind of idea of moral absolutes, doesn't it? That, you know, people are capable of justifying any action, no matter how horrible, in the right circumstances. That, and obviously cycles of violence are kind of self-defeating. But the genius, I think, with this here is that you take the player along with you every step of the way. Like, you tug their sympathies one way, then you yank them the other way, and then you go another way as well. And, you know, I kind of, when I played this game, I thought this is going to be almost like gaming's Last Jedi. I imagine it's going to be really divisive in that way. And I wondered whether you found that within the team it was divisive, not in terms of the quality, but in terms of people struggling to move their sympathies to those different places.
Yes, although it was, I'd say most people quickly understood what it is we're after and how we're leveraging this genre, the gameplay, these characters to tell this dual conflict story about empathy, about seeing a conflict from two different perspectives. But there were some, it was really hard because there were some people that joined Naughty Dog because of how much they loved The Last of Us. Like, that inspired them to get into video games.
Yeah.
And now they're coming in and they're like, wait, you're doing what to Joel? And like, Ellie is no longer this like sweet, innocent beacon of light in this world of darkness. And it's like, yeah, you know, in growing up and surviving in this world, you have to commit sometimes awful acts. And I think sometimes the most hardcore fans of the first game struggled at first with some of the narrative choices we're after. But I think ultimately most people, not everybody, but 99% of people understood this is what it takes to tell this kind of story.
And I mean, the main way you kind of achieve that empathetic shift is the switch, the big switch at the halfway point when we move from Ellie to Abby. We play with Abby slightly at the beginning, but when we shift to Abby at that critical moment as well, you know, with the confrontation moment. And it's funny, like, I had an almost visceral reaction to that moment, to being forced to play as Abby when you hate her that much. And it's like, it felt like looking down at the gun in your hands after you've just accidentally shot someone. It was like a sense of revulsion, like you don't want to do it. And you gradually, bit by bit, come around. And I think that's a genius piece of emotional manipulation. I wonder, how hard did you have to work to get that just right? Because it's a very hard line to walk.
Extremely hard. That was the biggest challenge of this game, is to make players empathetic to Abby, a person that has brutally tortured and killed a fan favorite character in the beginning of the story. And the whole thing is designed in such a way so you hate her. So like, a lot of players, again, not everybody, but a lot of players are like, I can't wait to torture her back, because that's how our minds work. Our minds so easily tip into that kind of primal violence when we witness something horrible happening. And there's so many examples in the real world you could point to where that happens. So the challenge for this game was, what can we do? What kind of story can we tell to make you see Abby as human? As not just like, right, because your instinct is to reduce her to less than human so you could justify what you're going to do to her later. And you see now players, I love the conversations. I love seeing players say, she's a monster. No, she's even better than Ellie. She's better than Joel. And just the back and forth of that is, I think, the kind of conversation we should be having about any conflict in the world.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's horrible human beings that are psychotic and serial killers. And that's not what we're trying to say, like, okay, everybody is good. But everybody is complicated, especially when you get into regions of the world that suffer from cycle of violence, and there are collateral damage and people that die on the side and kids that get murdered, and it's awful stuff. And the only way we could get past it is to say, what's their perspective? What's the perspective on the other side? Because without understanding it, you can never get past it, right? Ultimately, the cycle ends when both sides decide to stop it. If only one side decides to stop it, it keeps going.
Yeah.
It doesn't end. So yes, the whole structure, the whole challenge, like, can we put you in Abby's shoes? And can we get you to see what it's like to be her? And the pitfall and the thing we said early on was like, that means we can't just make her morally good across the board, because you will feel it's not a real person. And then I think you'll push back and resist that. So to show her she has positive qualities and she has these negative qualities and she makes some awful choices along the way. Sure. But that's how you humanize someone. It's seeing their flaws, seeing how despite their motivation, they make bad decisions. Despite understanding that the cycle of violence is bad, she's still ready to kill Ellie and Dina when you know, she felt wronged again by her and like the love of her life was killed by Ellie, like towards the end of Seattle. But that's the relationship we have with anger, with frustration. It's not like, okay, I've been enlightened and it's over. No, you regress and you come back, and we wanted to capture the nuance of that.
And you do it all the way through the game as well, and even down to the fact that even the, you know, quote unquote cannon fodder type characters, they have names, they call out to each other, they feel like humans. And I think, you know, rather than just randomly slaughtering everyone, which to be fair, I actually did, but you do feel bad about it, you know, when they're calling out like Chris, like the body on the floor. And just talking about those characters, I wanted to ask, how did you settle on, you know, the wolves and the Seraphites? Were you looking specifically for groups that had a kind of a distinct contrast to each other as opposed to the hunters from the original game?
Yeah, like every time we add a group or even a character to The Last of Us, we're like, what's a different perspective? Right, we've seen the military in the first game, and we see how, okay, they are able to bring rule of law and safety through oppression. We now see Jackson, and you see, okay, here is a community that's trying to restore law and order the way that we know it today. And then it's like, okay, what are some other groups we can explore? So it's like, well, what is it like to have a secular militaristic group, not quite like the military, but one that has taken over their supplies and is trying to govern by force? And right, again, they feel like their motivation is correct, is that they're trying to bring law and order back, but not in the way that Jackson does, right? Jackson is like brings people in and is sometimes to a fault, which is why like Joel and Tommy ultimately don't see what they're stepping into. Whereas the WLF, the wolves, are much more xenophobic and don't let other people in. And then to see, okay, well, how does religion play into all this? And here's another group that's xenophobic from a kind of a spiritual standpoint and feel like they've been ordained the same land. And again, it's trying to capture, mirror some conflict in the world. Obviously, it's a much more stylized and genre take on it. But to say like both of these groups see themselves as right, and either one of them could just move to a nearby town and the conflict would be over, but they both feel like they're in the right and they've dug their heels in. And that's why that conflict is ultimately destructive to both of them.
You do feel that. And I think as the game progresses, you think, oh, right, in my head, I know these are bad guys. And, oh, maybe they're not. And I've seen them. And even the Seraphites, you see their families when you go to the island. You see that even they're living like, you know, okay, slightly quirky, but normal people. But there are a lot of relationships in this game which play out. And let's talk about Dina and Ellie's relationship. So we found out that Ellie was gay in the first game's DLC, which is kind of easy to forget as the character, it fits that character so well. It feels kind of organic, like from the start. But here we see her exploring her sexuality, and the partnership they have leads to a very different character interaction than you had with Joel and Ellie. I wondered whether that was kind of the thought process behind that, because if, for example, you paired her with Tommy, it would have felt perhaps a little bit too familiar.
Yeah, it's again, we're trying to explore different kinds of characters and different kinds of relationship. So with Joel, it was much more paternal, protective. Joel is teaching Ellie, here's how you survive in this world. And Ellie and Dina started more as equals. And with Left Behind, we already told a story of like a love blossoming. And we didn't want to repeat that kind of journey again. So to say, okay, here are two girls that are best friends. They know each other intimately before they're romantically involved even. So even right, if they didn't get romantically involved, Dina would be going on this journey with Ellie, just like Jesse does, because here's this tight-knit group that love each other so much due to their friendship. And then there's like a romantic aspect that comes into it as well. And part of the thinking there is to say, okay, well, Dina has more of Ellie's innocence from the first game, where because Ellie had just witnessed this atrocity happening to her father figure. So we needed someone to bring a bit more lightheartedness to that journey. And we do that through Dina. And then the other thing is Dina represents the life in Jackson. Dina has lived in Jackson for much longer than Ellie. So she's constantly a representation of what Ellie stands to lose if she doesn't let this really dark pursuit go. And the stakes rise. And then you also see for someone like Dina, and again, it's an exploration of love, where like she does what she does, and she goes on Ellie's journey, and she's complicit in a lot of Ellie's journey because of her love for Ellie. And then at some point, she has a baby, and then the love shifts, and her responsibility shifts, and she can no longer allow this thing to continue because she has a greater love now for this child. Mm. And that's ultimately what where she sees that Ellie has not hit bottom, and she can't wait for her to do so. And she threatens her and ultimately leaves her because of it.
That's a really tough moment, because I guess, as was intentional, when she's sitting on the tractor with the baby, you kind of feel that's the end of the game. And then you realize she has that flashback, but you see she's got PTSD, and you see that she just can't function until she sees this through. It's really heartrending when she leaves the farm and goes back out.
Well, that's Ellie's struggle, is like, unlike Joel, Ellie is a hothead. She has a chip on her shoulder. You see it the way she killed David in the first game. You see it how she almost hits Bill when he just says when he handcuffs her to her pipe. So there's an anger that is deep inside Ellie that she has to work through. And because of that, she knows what the right thing to do is, but her emotions are so overwhelming, she can't. And that's the conversation she has with Dina. It's like she says, I can't let it go. I know what I need to do. I'm not like you. I can't do it. I mean, ultimately she does, and she saves a little bit of humanity within her, and right, that's her journey towards redemption eventually.
Yeah,
but at a great cost.
Because as you say, eventually she does make that decision and she does end that cycle, but that wasn't originally the ending, was it? You'd had for a long time that she was going to kill Abby. Like, what was the thinking behind that originally, and then what made you ultimately change that?
Originally, it was going to be, as you're saying, a darker ending where Ellie kills Abby, and then returns to the farm. And then we had different versions of it, but someone random, like some side character that you killed, their relative was there waiting for you to show that, right, even outside this core fight between Ellie and Abby, there's a cost to all these other people you're killing on the side. And ultimately that person is there to torture and kill Ellie. And in hurting her, they realize you're just a stupid kid, and they walk away. And it's like, it felt kind of like interesting in an ironic way that it wasn't the main character stopping it. It was just some random person. But so thematically, it resonated with us a lot. But then it felt like, oh, we're being too much of a slave to the themes, and we've lost the character. We've lost that inside Ellie, there's good, right? Again, her motivation is love. And ultimately, we wanted to show that's what's deep inside. And right, the Robert McKee, the way he talks about storytelling, is you apply as much pressure as you can on the character, and only through pressure, the choices they make define who they are. And ultimately, right, despite the horrible things that Ellie does, there's good inside of her. And we wanted to show that.
Because there's that moment, isn't there, when she has cut Abby down and she's getting at the boat, and she pauses and she's almost going to let her go. And then she just says to her, she can't let her go. Like, what's going through her head at that point?
So much, right? It's hard to pin down any decision a person makes to like one particular thing, but it's like, It's the image of, right, Joel murdered Joel and his bloody being a bloody mess. And the person that caused that is a few feet away from me. And then can I let that go? And again, she struggles. She knows what the right thing is. And she's so terrified of what that would mean to let her go. Like, will the nightmares just continue forever? And right, her emotions get the best of her. And she turns around. She's like, she believes she needs to finish it. Despite like Abby being this emaciated person, it's not the same person that killed Joel anymore. That's not who Abby is. Abby has gone on this redemption journey and now is caring for this kid. And Ellie is, in a way, blinded to see that Abby has become Joel. Abby has become someone that is protecting someone, going to the ends of the earth to save someone just the way Joel did to her. And only once she has like essentially Abby dead, but she's essentially won, that's when she like sees it. She like kind of like sees the Matrix in a way and realizes what it's all about.
Because she sees that image. There's a flash of Joel, isn't there, with the guitar. Like, she almost like it feels like she's found some kind of peace. Like, there's her touchstone to Joel when she's in that fight.
Yeah, that's very purposeful to say, like, all the memories she has of Joel, the images of Joel, all these violent images. And then in this moment of clarity, right, so much of our conversation around Ellie is about her journey is one of addiction in a way. So in this moment of clarity, she sees something else about the relationship she had with Joel. There's a different kind of memory. And, you know, why she lets her go, it's so complicated. It's so, like, complex. And I love reading people's interpretation of, like, is it because love is there? Is it because she had a memory of, like, when she started her journey to forgive Joel? And that's why she's doing it. is it like I was saying earlier, it's like she sees the Matrix and she sees the futility of it all, and she realizes this will not make it anything go, this will not fix anything.
Yeah.
And there's no right answer here. That's like, we left it vague on purpose because we want you to reflect on it yourself.
It's very hard to play. Like, I remember at one point where you have to mash the button to drive the knife into Abby's chest, and I refused to do it and died as a result.
You're not the only one.
Because you love both of these characters. You're just like, I don't want to kill her. And it's nice that you threw us a bone there and actually didn't make her do it, because I think that ending you talked about would have been perhaps a little bit too bleak. But you give us something at the end, don't you? You give us that moment. You give us a gift, as it were, amid all the darkness, which is the knowledge that she had made up with Joel before the end. Like, they'd started to make peace with each other. And I think that's a lovely note to end the game on, that there's that little bit of hope, that sense of peace from it. Was that a deliberate sort of way of almost softening the experience for the player?
It, just like everything else in the game, it was like an ongoing organic discovery. Like, so we had that scene and knew that, right? Because there's like several timelines, right? There's the Abby timeline in Seattle, there's the Ellie timeline in Seattle, and then there's like the Ellie timeline over the years between the first game and the second game, which really, you saw the shift in her relationship with Joel. So we knew what that journey was, but we weren't sure where to place those moments. And we played with all sorts of different versions of it. And the one that felt the best is to kind of like tie up that story at the end and say, all these things kind of run in parallel. And just the way your mind works, right? When you think about dreams or memories, they're constantly out of order, and you're remembering different aspects of a relationship with a person, and it really depends on your state of mind or where you're at and how you remember them. And that was the best version to reflect the kind of themes we're after.
Because I guess it wouldn't have fit the game if she'd come back and Dina had been waiting with open arms. Like, you need there to be that empty house. You need her to kind of face the consequences of it, but then leave, I guess, it open. That does she go off to Jackson? Does she find Dina there? Like, you do leave it open and ambiguous.
Yeah, and right, I've seen some people have a conversations like, oh, I wish I saw Ellie's redemption. I wish I saw, can you come back from that? And my answer to that is like, you did. You saw it with Abby, because you see, you're getting one journey of like someone's on the path towards hitting bottom, towards becoming a monster in a way, and maybe stopping short of that. And then you see someone's journey of redemption, of coming back from such an act, of doing horrible things and finding a positive purpose in life. And despite how hard it is, sticking to that purpose and seeing this is what love is about. Yeah. This is the positive quality of love versus this kind of a very negative, destructive quality.
And the other big rug pull you managed to do in this, which is the genius use of flashbacks, is that you're very judicious in when you drop the revelation that Ellie knows, that she knows what Joel did at the end of the first game. And to a certain extent, it changes the tone of this game and Ellie's motivation and what's going through her head. The fact that she knows, it hits quite hard. Like, was that another piece that kind of moved around where you were going to drop that in?
Yes. And ultimately, right, there's like, you see the... So much of this game is like seeing kind of actions and then making you judge them in a particular way and then giving you greater context later and making you reflect on them, right? So just like you're going on this journey and killing Jordan and killing Nora and finding Abby, and then later you get the context of like, oh man, I viewed those actions maybe not in the full weight that they deserve. In the same way that, you know, when Ellie goes on this journey and you have one understanding and then realize, oh, she knew, and she knew what the Fireflies were after. But now her love for Joel is overriding all of that, and she's willing to make them all suffer because how much she cared for this man.
Last thing before I let you go, I just wanted to ask one thing about Lev. Now, Lev's a great character, and this is a really interesting one. And I think the character that humanizes Abby in many ways more than anything else, as you say, because it makes you see the Joel-Ellie dynamic from the first game. And Lev ultimately pulls her back from the brink and stops her from killing Dina. So, I mean, what was the thinking behind that character and also the decision to make him be a trans character and to have Ian Alexander play him? Because the representation in this game feels so effortless and organic. And I think that really sets it apart from so many other titles.
Yeah, there's so many things that maybe seem effortless that require a tremendous amount of effort. I will say, like, just going back to like your earlier question is, why do we have the WLF and the Seraph fights? It's the same kind of answer of why do we have a trans character, an Asian character, a Mexican character? It's like we were trying to find different perspectives. And even saying that, I feel like it kind of belittles the characters a little bit, because the trans character is Asian, is someone that struggles with spirituality, is someone that has like a quirky sense of humor, is someone that is so curious about the world and has been repressed. And so that's just one aspect of them that helps us see the world through someone a little different eyes or someone's familiar's eyes, depending on like where you are at. Mm. But the point is, all those things are done in service of reflecting the world that we live in, so you could better understand the kind of conflict. Again, we're in a zombie genre, and yeah. It's very easy, I think, to dismiss the game and just say, okay, it's a zombie story. But like, some of the best stories that reflect back on society are genre stories. Yeah. Night of the Living Dead dealt with racism at the time. So our hope was that to just find characters that are varied, treat them authentically. Mm. And that means doing the research. It means consulting with people. But then it means kind of wading into sometimes uncomfortable waters or sensitive material, but just owning it and owning that that's who they are and that's what it takes to treat them authentically in this genre.
There was one more thing just before you go that I wanted to mention, which was music. And music has been so integral to this saga from the acoustic score in the first game and indeed in this one, but it feels much more narratively present here, that the guitar is Ellie's connection to Joel, and the song Future Days, which kind of, even in the lyrics of the song, encapsulates the whole story. You know, if I were to lose you, I would lose myself. And I wondered, how early was that a part of this game? Like, and how hard did you have to fight to get it?
It was very early. It originated from when we did this thing called One Night Live, where we had the actors on stage performing scenes from the game to a live audience. And then we streamed that, then we cut the stream, and I had written an extra scene just for the stage. So I wanted to take advantage of this opportunity to be on the stage, be like, oh, it's like writing a mini play in a way, kind of like a one scene play. And it was about Joel gifting Ellie this guitar post the events of Last of Us 1 and singing to her Future Days. And this was back in 2014, maybe. I don't quite remember now. Yeah. And then once we start full production of this game, I knew that's the opening scene of this game. And I'm like, I knew we had to get the rights, which is different when you do it on stage versus when you put it in the game.
Yeah, cool.
Screens. And it was like a long journey to convince Pearl Jam's manager to like hear us out, come over and pitch him the story. And, you know, they're very particular about what they like their music to. And especially with video games, it's been challenging. And I know some people that have tried and failed to get a Pearl Jam song. But we were lucky enough that it resonated with someone over there, and they agreed to it. And now the song is part of The Last of Us.
It's beautiful every time it's played. And also the Take On Me cover, which is such a stunning moment in the game, which I guess some players could even miss if they don't go into the record store. But that's a beautiful, beautiful moment.
Cheers.
It really is. I could talk about this all day, but I'm sure you have other things to do. Neil, thank you so much for joining us and taking the time to talk about this phenomenal game.
Cool, thank you. Yeah, I'm glad it resonated with you. I love talking about it.
Right, let's jump in with our own reactions to what they created. So before we get into the plot stuff, you've kind of already alluded to this, but it feels like with the first game, it had that ambiguous ending. It had an ending where Joel has killed everyone. Ellie wakes up. He lies to her. He tells her there are other immune people. Her immunity means nothing. And she doesn't quite buy it. And she pushes him on that point. She makes him, as they're looking out over Jackson, she makes him promise that he's telling the truth. And he lies to her. And she goes, okay, then. Cut to black. Really ambiguous ending. Some say kind of a perfect ending. And to take that and now build a story on top of that, that's a big risk. Do you not think?
It's a big risk, but it pays off. I was surprised that they waited so long to give us clarity on whether or not Ellie knew the truth before she set out on her quest. Mm. And it makes the second playthrough, which I still haven't finished yet, I'm a long way away from finishing, very different, because now sort of you have that knowledge of what actually went down. But yeah, it's a big risk, but it pays off in a big way. The phrase that kept re-entering my mind when playing this game is that everyone is the hero of their own story, which is a phrase you hear time and time again, but I don't think it's ever resonated more with me than it does with The Last of Us Part 2. And not only that, but that it makes you root for both sides of that journey over the course of 20, 30 hours is just a ridiculously impressive feat.
Weirdly, the thing that came to my mind was Pulp Fiction. And I remember seeing Pulp Fiction for the first time, and you're following Travolta, he's the hero, and then you switch to Bruce Willis, and then they come face to face, and one of them kills the other one. And these are two characters who are kind of heroes, and you like both of them. And the way that Tarantino kind of played with your empathy and the fact that you'd got connected to both of these characters and then one of them guns down the other one, And obviously the chronology kind of really, I was reminded of that while playing this, of just really ingenious switching of perspectives and just the way it was jumping back and forth in time. I just thought it was incredibly effective.
That actually reminded me of Waves, which came out a few months back now. But there's a similar thing that happens in Waves where you're following sort of one character and then it switches midway through. And in The Last of Us Part 2 playing it, it was annoying to me initially when it happened, because when the perspective shifts to Abby, it comes at a really sort of big moment in the game. And I'm like, I want to see what happens in this moment. I don't want to be spending time with Abby. And it took, like, in my mind, I was like, this is just going to be like a quick, you know, 10-minute cutscene, right? We're not going to spend much time. It took me like a good 30, 40 minutes. Yeah. Like, hold on. We're actually going deep into Abby. Exactly. It took me a while.
Because I think the first Abby one that you get quite early on.
The very beginning of the game. Yeah.
I think we could argue about that a little bit, because I'm not entirely sure that they should have dropped Abby's perspective in that early. I wonder if it would have been more effective if they'd waited till that moment halfway through and then switched, and it would have been even more kind of shocking. But yeah, I thought it was going to be, I'm like you, Amon, I thought it was going to be like a 20-minute scene and then back, and it wasn't. It just kept going and going. I was like, oh, okay, this is interesting.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about that for a second before we get on to the sort of full structure and the switch halfway through. So if you go back to the prologue, as you say, it splits your perspective. You start off as Joel very briefly, then you get to use Ellie, and then you do switch to Abby. And you switch to Abby during that sequence where, you know, the horde sequence, which is quite full on, actually, very early on in the game. It's great. But it is quite jarring that you wake up, Abby's in the little ski lodge, she wakes up, she goes out with Owen, voiced by Patrick Fugit, by the way. And they go out and discuss it, and then you realize why she's here. You realize that she's there to get Joel, and that's quite jarring as well. And you feel this bit, well, I've played with Joel, I've just had some time with Ellie, why am I now using this strange woman who I'm not sure I like? And it's an odd thing. I think Ali Gross talked about this a little bit in an interview where she's talked about they felt they needed to establish sympathy for Abby quite early on. They needed to give her some dimension. But I know what you mean. Like, even having played her for a bit, when Joel saves her life and then she ultimately... And it's brutal, that bit where she shoots him in the leg with a shotgun and then bind the wound and starts, I'm working him over it.
Literally, James, in my new game plus, I skipped that scene. I couldn't put myself through it again. I literally skipped the scene. Yeah,
I don't like it. But I just wonder if it would have actually been more effective had they not done that and then you had to work even harder to earn her sympathy. Because actually, I didn't really sympathize with her that much, because I figured out quite early on that she's after Joel. You know, when she keeps talking about he's here, it's obvious, right?
And so
I was like, no, I don't like this. So I felt like something was off. And so, yeah, I just wonder if it might have been more effective. You're playing, and I don't know, maybe they didn't want to switch back to Joel again at that point.
But I mean, as you say, that death of Joel hits like a 10-ton truck. Like, it is absolutely brutal, because you've been this character, you've lived this character, you've loved this character all through the first game. And then to see him tortured to death, and the way Ellie is forced to watch him die as well, that's horrific. I read an interview where Druckmann was actually talking about how originally they had it scripted that because Joel has had his brains beaten in and he's half delirious, the last word out of his mouth is Sarah. He looks at Ellie and calls her Sarah. And apparently it was Troy Baker who thought that was a bad move. He said, no, just have him say nothing. It would be better if he just doesn't say anything, which I think was the right decision, actually. I think that would have been, there would have been a slight discordant note there. But that is a moment. I was bereft. And it comes, you know, on the heels of... So bear in mind the way it plays out. So you see Abby get him. You see that begin. And then you cut back to Ellie and Dina, and they have that lovely moment with the joints in the basement. And there's lots of character stuff going on. And it's not until Jesse comes down and says, look, Joel is missing. Yeah, it's a brutal, brutal scene.
Maybe it took the edge off her witnessing it, that she was slightly high. I don't know.
Perhaps.
Hopefully.
We can but hope.
Yeah.
But that that prologue sets up the nature of the game. So if the first, and I think they talked about the idea that continuing the first game is a difficult thing to do, and partly because Joel's story arc is finished. Like, he has done his redemption arc, he's finished. And to take that character anywhere after that does feel like, where does he go from here? Like, his arc is really fulfilling. Whereas Ellie's arc is just beginning in the first game. And I think that's definitely the more interesting one here. It's, can you make her almost go on a similar journey to him? Like, you take away the one thing that she cares about and see what happens to her. And I'm sure you guys are aware, like the reaction to this game, the reception of this game has been quite divisive. There's been an extraordinary amount of hate from some quarters of the internet. And why do you guys think that is?
If this has made me think about the way we critique things, because I think there are times, and I fully admit that there are times when I have also fallen into this trap, that we're so focused, if we're especially excited for something as well, we're so focused on what we want to see happen that we forget to analyze what actually did happen. And so much of the negative feedback that I've watched and read of this game are from people who have, in some cases, envisioned entirely different storylines to the one we've been given. But this is the story Neil Druckmann and Halley Gross wanted to tell. And for me, all the beats they were going for, in my mind, they hit. The storytelling is ballsy as hell. And, you know, I don't agree with many of the decisions the characters make, but, you know, as far as I can see, every single one of those decisions was earned. And you can't help but respect that. Storytelling, in which the characters don't do what you want them to do, is the hardest storytelling to pull off. But as I say, if you've seeded character, and if you've done that character work right, then, you know, you can't help but respect that. It actually reminded me of Star-Lord in Infinity War. You know, that fight with Thanos, they have him, that should be the end of it. And then he goes and does something stupid. And, you know, when you're watching for the first time, you're like, Star-Lord, what are you doing? Literally the fate of the universe, what are you doing? But if you go back and look at the evolution of Star-Lord, you can understand why he's reacting that way, as frustrating as it might be. There are many instances in The Last of Us 2 which are similar.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Amon. Like, the character flaws are what make these characters interesting. I think there are probably a lot of people who just wanted to see Joel and Ellie run around with flamethrowers and you know, submachine guns, whatever you prefer, and just fighting zombies in cool set pieces. And people, there are some people who would have been happy with that, but that's not what these guys want to do. And, you know, I've been reading up on some of the reactions, and it's awful. Like, people have been getting death threats. I mean, that's insane to me. But it's a game that absolutely pushes people's buttons. Like, they must have known that this was going to get quite a strong emotion, because that's what they were going for.
Yeah,
obviously, that is too strong an emotion. But, I mean, they do stuff repeatedly in this game, and I'm sure we'll get onto it, which shocks the hell out of you. And you're like, wow. And it sort of smacks you in the face. Alice the dog, RIP. So there was always going to be people. I think this game would have failed if some people hadn't got upset. Yeah, I think we're all upset. We're just, some people manifest it in different ways.
But it's a more difficult sell, isn't it? The first game is a positive emotional experience. Don't get me wrong, you go through the ringer and bad things happen. The death of Sam in particular is absolutely brutal, which I think at the end of the summer sequence in the first game. But, you know, you're going somewhere, you're protecting someone, there's a positivity about it. This game is entirely negative in its emotional state. It's a game about hate, it's her descent into rage and vengeance, and her losing her ability to kind of think clearly. And some of the reviews I read when this first came out, a lot of the complaints were, I didn't want any of it to happen. I didn't agree with any of the decisions the characters made, and I didn't want any of it to happen. And it's like, and exactly as you're saying, that's fine. Yeah. But knowing Ellie as we do, of course she was going to do that. Like, if you look at how she is in the first game, she's got a real temper on her. And, you know, you see it when, you know, she's interacting with David, the cannibal leader, voiced by Nolan North in the first game, and she can't keep her mouth shut. She can't, she has to tell him to go fuck himself. She bites him, she breaks his finger, she stabs him, she doesn't give a shit, because she's a little ball of fury. And she has grown into that here as well. So of course she was going to go on a rampage of revenge.
That's really interesting what you said about, you don't always want to do what they make you do. And there are definitely scenes where they're like, press the square button now. And I was like, I don't want to press it.
And
like,
I didn't.
But you haven't got a choice.
I have died on several occasions because I refused to do it because I didn't agree with what was being done.
But I think that's really interesting because, you know, say during the final battle on the beach, you don't want to do it, but then part of you does want to do it because you've had ingrained from years and years of video gaming that you want to fight who's in front of you. You know, that's the point of the game, is to fight what's in front of you. And at the same time, another part of you is pulling back and going, I don't want to do it. And it's interesting because I think that's kind of the point, in a way, that these characters are battling two impulses at the same time. They're battling the anger, and at the same time, they have the awareness that they shouldn't be doing what they're doing, but they still do it. And I think that's really, I've never seen a video game do that before, where it's giving you that complex.
The morality of this game is very complex because it does, I mean, yes, it's about the cycles of violence and that you have to break them. And I think in Neil Druckmann, coming from Israel, it's the topic that's very close to his heart. But I think what it really does push out is that, again, it is all about perspective, that this is not a game where there are, I mean, if there are any villains in this game, it's the Rattlers at the end. They're probably the only enemy that aren't particularly nuanced, yep. But there are no villains other than that. None of Abby's crew are villains. Some, one of them, at least, is a bellend, the one in the cap, but do you know what I mean? Like,
is that Manny?
No, I like Manny.
No, not Manny. No. Is it what's his name? Is it, I wonder if it's Jerry. I forget. The first one you kill.
Bloody Jerry.
But, do you know what I mean? Like, there are no villains. The Seraphites aren't the villains. The Wolves aren't the villains. The Fireflies. No one is a villain here. Everyone is pursuing their own agenda, which is incompatible with everyone else's.
Isaac, right?
Even Isaac's not a villain. If you look at the backstory, like, you know, because you read all the little reports and it fills in the backstory and stuff. Like, the Wolves grew up under the oppression of Fedra, and they began, like the Fireflies, as freedom fighters trying to, you know, bring order and throw off oppression. And then they ultimately became exactly the what they hated. Yeah. Yeah. But I'm sure Isaac justifies his actions, and he is, as Amon said, the hero of his own narrative. I don't think he would ever see himself as the villain. He's just like, we have to kill the Scars. The Scars are killing us. We tried a peace treaty with them. It imploded. We've got to wipe them out. Like, it's pragmatic.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really interesting. I loved the world building in this. I love how they took the first film, the mythology of that first game, rather, and took it off in interesting directions. And it's totally plausible that if you, in this kind of vacuum that's left with society breaking down, that you'd have some people becoming this religious cult and buying into the whole kind of culty aspect of it. And then you would have, you know, yeah, that you would have these groups coming out that would become more and more ordered and tyrannical. And so, yeah, and the Rattlers, I mean, it's, you know, they're the kind of the Sons of Anarchy gone wrong.
Yeah, because you don't, unless you read all the material that you find, it's quite hard to work out what they are. Like, from what I gather, they're like a mercenary group based out of Santa Barbara.
I feel like they're bikers. I know, you never see them on a bike, but I feel like there's a real
one looks like a biker.
He looks like Ron Perlman in Sons of Anarchy. But yeah, I thought there was something about that kind of like the West Coast biker kind of group. I don't know, it felt like they were modeled after them. But
yeah, I mean, nasty bastards. You mentioned sort of, you know, finding all the different material and the letters and everything else. This is a game that really makes you want to do that.
Yeah.
The level of detail is just incredible, to the point where, you know, I found myself checking at regular intervals, has Ellie written anything new in their diary? What is it? I need to go see. And all the stuff that she did write in her diary was great, especially pertaining to her relationship with Dina and her getting sort of more confident in that relationship, that there's some sort of additional things that she puts in her diary about it, which are really just add even more color to it in a really cool way.
I like the lyrics, the song's lyrics, I mean, I will say I'm maybe of the mind that there are too many letters left around. Like, does everyone write a letter when they're about to die? Like,
you know, I don't say know what you do in the situation.
I'm dying. Someone give me a pen.
I mean, I guess they've got no TV, they've got no Wi-Fi. There's lots of time to go. I mean, pens must be quite easy to find in this post-apocalyptic way. So, I thought there was maybe too much documentation. I wonder if there might have been another way or another few ways of they could have got that information out. I don't know, maybe they didn't want to do the cassette tape thing because Resident Evil does that, but
I mean, if you haven't got time to write a note, you probably don't have time to hang on, let me just record a little audio diary.
It's easier.
Everyone
seemed to have like PS Vitas in the Abby's gang.
You kill the last PS Vita owner is murdered in The Last of Us Part 2. Also, and I like the fact she's playing Hotline Miami on it as well, which is a game about massive amounts of violence. So
incredible,
which is quite fun.
And then someone's got, there's like a lot of battery, like a surprising amount of batteries going on because someone's listening to Ice Cube in the hospital as well. Like, I enjoyed that bit where you just suddenly, you hear something and you're like, what the hell? And you're like aiming your flamethrower or submachine gun, whichever you prefer. And then it turns out to be an Ice Cube track, which is great. And you need to use your AK.
Yes, you did indeed.
Because there's a bloater.
I like the journal. I like the fact that because she's not maybe the most forthcoming person, you get to see her in a monologue by looking at it in the journal, which worked very well. But what did you guys think of Ellie and Dina's relationship? So Ellie being queer was something that comes from the Left Behind DLC. Ashley Johnson was, you know, when Druckmann told her, you know, what do you feel about like Ellie being queer? And she said that she thought it fit perfectly with the character. And I agree, like organically, it almost feels like it was planned from the start. But obviously they build on that here in this one.
That was quite controversial to begin with, wasn't it? Because I remember there being the trailer came out and with the kiss, and some people got angry at that, and it's like, just wait. If you're angry about that, you know. But I don't know. I thought it was great. I thought it felt completely organic. I thought they totally sold those characters as a couple. I really liked all of it. I did think Dina was going to get murdered.
So did I.
Was like, very early on, I was like, she is not going to last 2 hours in this game. But she did, and I was really... I just found their story really touching, like right up to going back to the farm. One of the most like hard-hitting moments where you walk, and I knew it was going to happen when you're walking up to the farmhouse. You're like, there's going to be no one there.
No.
But when you walk in and everything's gone, and Dina is really good. She must be great at checking out of hotels. She's spotless.
She's had it professionally cleaned and then really passive-aggressively leave all Ellie's shit there.
That was good. But
the farm sequence is a funny one as well, because I thought that was the end of the game. Like when you're sitting on the tractor holding the baby, I thought this is the last shot of the game, so I was like savoring it. Little did I know there's a whole other sequence to come. But makes sense, doesn't it, that she sees this life with Dina, but she's always slightly at odds with it. Like she feels like she doesn't deserve it. She's got this, it's at odds with her mission as well.
I thought it was absolutely beautifully done. It's the character that gets everything she's ever wanted and she has to, and she walks away from it because of this anger that she's got that she can't process or do anything with. It's great.
Well, that's one of the beautiful parallels between Abby and Ellie's journeys, because Abby, you know, she's built herself into this muscular person to go after Joel. And because of sort of her quest for vengeance, she has denied herself a life with Owen. And that has led to complications with their relationship. Now, Ellie has this life with Dina, but she can't rest with Dina because she is still on her journey, her quest for vengeance. So I thought that was really dumb. But yeah, I love the Ellie and Dina relationship. One thing I sort of said to James sort of weeks ago, I love how casually inclusive this game is. Mm. And it's not tokenistic. These are fully formed characters when you actually get fully formed sequences where they're being gay or trans or what have you, and which is something that, you know, big films like your Star Wars, like, you know, some of the Marvel films could actually learn from, because this is not just like a tokenistic kiss, okay, that's it, you know, they're actually sort of, you know, going into these scenes and and showing really sort of fully formed relationships in that way, and I freaking love that.
Mm. And video game is a medium that has not been, that progressive traditionally, right? It's a very macho, manly. It's all about the guns and the violence and the killing. And so to combine the two elements and have all this quite subversive, progressive stuff in, as well as the flamethrowers and the machine guns.
It goes even down to, you know, Abby's body type. When do you see that in video games?
Yeah.
Almost never. But it really sort of works for that character, and then sort of informs her character as well. As I say, she's done that because, and we know this from the flashback we get years ago, about which shows her with her father and shows her sort of obviously a lot younger, but her physique is completely different. Mm. It's only after that event that she's trained herself. You know, I'm going after Joel. I need to be ready for him, and that is why we get her physique in the way we have, and it's a really underrepresented body type, but it's very welcome here. I thought it was awesome.
When you cut back to her before she's bulked up, you know, it's you could only do that in a video game, really. I guess you could do it with CG like Captain America, but
or just hire Christian Bale. But it is incredible. And she does, and that they make a point of that. And it works on two levels, doesn't it? It works because it differentiates her gameplay style from Ellie. Like, she plays like Joel. She hits like a truck. She's less agile. She doesn't have the knife. But when she hits them,
she doesn't need it.
She doesn't need the knife. it's a different way of playing. And I think that's nice, the way they mix up the two parts of it there. But you mentioned the violence briefly there. And the question I would have for you, some people have, you know, described this as kind of like torture porn. It's too graphic. It's too unpleasant. Did you think the violence went too far, or did you think, you know, it serves a story and it was necessary?
Yeah, I think it definitely goes far, but I wouldn't say too far. I thought the Joel scene was the most shocking for me.
And you don't really see an awful lot of that. Like, it cuts away. It's not an overly gory scene. It's emotionally upsetting, but you don't see a lot.
No. And I mean, there's the scene where, is it Nora that she, that Ellie yeah, is kind of has to torture to get the information
which
out of her.
Which you don't see either, but it's...
And you don't see it, but it feels real. And then when you see Ellie walk through into the cinema in the theater and she's got the blood all over her. Yeah, it could be a lot more gratuitous, but it definitely is bleak and it definitely is brutal.
Yeah.
You know, I think... When what's his face? Oh, I can't remember his name. The guy who gets shot in the head by Abby.
Oh, what, Jesse?
Jesse,
or Tommy?
That's it. No, Jesse. Yeah, no, Jesse.
No, it's Tommy.
Well, Tommy gets shot. Yeah, they both get shot in the face, but Jesse dies.
Yeah. But Jesse, that hit me hard. Yeah. That was quite...
Because it's so throwaway, isn't it? He's just, oh, and he's dead.
I think that was the point why I messaged you, James. I was like, there's a bad idea to form an emotional attachment to anybody in this game. It's just, oh.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's a hell of a moment. I think the violence is pretty extreme, but even going down to the way the stealth kills are played out, like the way she like carves their throats open and then you upgrade her stealth kill and then it's a quick, and we slice the carotid artery and then a stab in the heart, like becomes ruthlessly efficient. But it is, I mean, it's quite full on, but I do think it's necessary. And I think like Ellie's descent into darkness and what she becomes in this, or what she nearly becomes in this, because she kind of pulls back from the brink at the very, very end, which we'll get onto, but what she's kind of turning into, I think you need that level of unpleasantness to make it land. Otherwise, it doesn't have teeth.
There's kind of the violence of passion, which can be very, you know, brutal and horrible. But the stuff that's really stuck with me and kind of haunts me is the way they depict just the organized violence of the people crucified all at the end, hanging up on the things.
Yeah, their entrails
and
ripped out.
And the rattlers caging people and stuff like that, which is just so kind of pessimistic about where we would go as a society were things to fall apart, that these evil groups would form. And I think it's brilliantly portrayed. It's like really stuck with me.
Because do you remember they showed footage, I think it was at E3 a number of years ago, where they showed some footage from the game and they showed the cinematic of Abby being hung. And obviously no one had a first clue who Abby was. A really odd piece of footage to show, actually, because A, it was focused on Abby, and B, it showed you the clipping of Yara's wings, which is, I would say, the most explicitly unpleasant moment in the game. And that seemed like a very odd thing to showcase, because it was obviously going to draw criticism, because it is deeply unpleasant. It is almost torture porn. That was an odd choice.
Yeah, I'd blocked that one out of my mind. Thanks for that.
Yeah, no problem. it's not a fun moment. Not a fun moment. But no. Let's talk about, so we go through Seattle. Seattle is obviously very different to the mixed American topography that we get in the first game. The weather obviously plays a large part in this one here. We've gone through our little mini open world bit at the beginning. We work all the way through this, through a number of set pieces. We get to that moment where she eventually, where Ellie's in the boat, the storm, which is sort of part metaphor, part real storm, as she's heading to the aquarium. She gets in there and she finds Owen and Mel. And I think the moment when she kills them, that is, again, it's not overly explicit, but the way she kills her and then pulls back the coat and sees that she's pregnant. And I think that's the moment where you see Ellie's like, what the fuck have I become?
Yeah. Now it's compounded by, you know, you mentioned it a few minutes ago. She goes back to the hideout and she is traumatized. And yeah, that is just one of many, many heavy moments. And yeah, in the moments when I wasn't playing the game, my first playthrough, like, it just, I couldn't stop thinking about it. And it was just, yeah, it was really, really heavy. But again, I don't think it was gratuitous, because you have moments like, you know, her reacting to it the way she did, it really sort of highlights what the violence is doing to her. Gratuitous violence is just like violence for the sake of violence's sake. And I don't think there's any of that really in the game.
She was going to give up at that point, right? They were going to go back to Jackson without finding Abby.
I think she was done. But she leaves the map behind very noticeably.
Yeah. Because like Tommy comes back and together agree that, you know, we're going to leave it the way it is. They're going to go back. But then Abby finds them and things take another turn.
Yeah, but that's a hell of a bold move, isn't it? You've got to that point in the game. You've got the climactic face-off between Abby and Ellie. And then it cuts. And then suddenly you're Abby and you're like, and like the revulsion. Like, I was like, the last thing in the world I wanted to be doing was controlling fucking Abby. But it's actually very smart that it's a flashback and it's her as a teenager and it's her going to save a fucking zebra. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like, it's really low key and it keys you into the sympathy quite early before bringing you to Abby the wolf.
I'm glad they found a way to top the giraffe from the first one. Part of me was wondering, is it going to be the same giraffe? I don't know. What animal did you guys think it was going to be?
I didn't see a zebra coming. I'll be honest with you.
You didn't spend a lot of time. No, the zebra was amazing. Like, very good zebra. Yeah. Very good. I thought they slightly missed an opportunity for a zombie shark in this game. You know, you're spending hours in an aquarium.
If it had been Resident Evil, absolutely.
Yeah, they would have absolutely had to shotgun a zombie shark.
In my mind, it was going to be an elephant. But, you know, zebra works too. Yeah. It's fine.
Yeah. but they really twist the knife with that scene, don't they? With the dad and you're slowly realizing he's a medical guy.
You killed her dad. Like you shot him in the face. Mm. And I don't know if you guys remember, like, when you first did that scene in The Last of Us Part 2, where you go into that room. Like, I was Joel at that point. I had become Joel so completely. I don't think I even let the surgeon finish his sentence before I shot him in the face. And then I shot the two other doctors again without even thinking twice about it. Because I was like, you're trying to kill Ellie. Fuck you all. And that was a really polarizing scene for a lot of people. Like, a lot of people wrestled with that scene. A lot of people didn't agree with it. They didn't like it. They didn't feel he should have killed the doctor. And I think because that was the most controversial scene in the first game, it makes absolute sense that this entire sequel hinges on that decision that he made in that moment.
I mean, it makes you start thinking about all of the probably 5,000 people you kill in this game, and each of them has their own story. Well, I mean, weirdly, the dogs like really hit me hard. Yeah. Like, I was killing those dogs, and I hated those dogs. And then suddenly, you're looking after one of them and petting it and throwing it a ball, and it's like, you motherfuckers, you know exactly what you're doing right now. And that, I mean, it's genius, because when Alice jumps at you and you're Ellie, you're like, fuck, die, and then. There's a whole backstory for Alice the dog, and it's horrible.
That only half worked for me. Like, with the dogs and stuff, it was definitely, I felt all the emotions you felt, Nick, and more. But, you know, they try and sort of have everyone have their story to a point in that, you know, if you kill someone, they'll call out their name and all that sort of stuff. At the end of the day, this is still a game, and to progress in this game, I need to do what I need to do. After a certain point, I wasn't as affected by it, especially if, you know, I tried to be stealthy and they killed me. And you know, if that happens once or twice or three times, I'm like, you know what? Forget you. I don't even care. I hate you now. You're going to die. I did appreciate the effort to try and make us care more about everybody. Mm-hmm. That's something which, as much as I like the Uncharted series, that those games don't do that. And I appreciated the effort, but it didn't all the way work.
Nathan Drake is a stone cold sociopath. I mean, I love those games, but the body count is nuts. And then he has a cutscene where he's having a beer with Sully and you're like, you've just murdered 4,000 people, you fucking maniac. Like, I mean, those games have, there's an underlying kind of issue at the heart of those games that you just go, this is fun, so I'm not going to think about it. But yeah, the Uncharted body counts are insane, and every time I finish one I usually go, that is insane, this guy would be locked up, he would be traumatized, he would be in therapy for the rest of his life, but he's not. And because it's a video game, you have to have the body count, otherwise it's not fun. But I really like that they've tried to wrestle with that very thing in these games. It doesn't always work, you know. There's a lot of dialogue in this game about the, because they apply it not just to Abby's gang and Ellie's crew, but it's Scars and the Wolves as well, that they try and show that actually this war has escalated for out of this tiny little thing, but neither side is in the wrong. Neither side is particularly evil. They're just reacting to something that someone else has done and getting revenge for it, and that's how these situations arise. But then you get to the Scars Island, and they're all like running around chanting stuff, and they're not particularly humanized, and so you don't really feel that bad for killing 100
farming,
of them.
Farming, you know, they're living an arable lifestyle. There are kids and stuff, you know.
But they're also just terrifying. They're doing those whistles.
They're clearly lunatics, but
you know, she will protect us.
Lunatics with farming in their minds.
They are lunatics that have good farming skills, and I admire them and respect them for that. But they do. I mean, there is a kind of a slight clash in them trying to do what say that message with the game, but at the same time, making it really fun to kill people.
Yes, it is. And it is. That's quite satisfying, isn't it?
It's incredibly satisfying. Shooting a dog with an arrow is just really fun in this game. But, yeah,
I'm not sure what that says about
it. Sniping with arrows is one of my favorite things to do when I'm in the grass. Just like, but can't see me.
The way they do the motion capture. I mean, like, I played this game through, and then I played The Last of Us remastered through, and now I've started this one again. But The Last of Us looks almost like rudimentary by comparison in terms of just graphically, of graphical fidelity. Like, they didn't have like proper facial mocap then. Like, the facial expressions on the characters in this game are unreal. The emotions they convey, the micro expressions. I mean, it really does help you understand and empathize with them. It's a hell of a thing. Now, we've talked about obviously becoming Abby. A lot happens. We spend a lot of time with Abby. We spend half the game being Abby, and we meet Lev and Yara, as we talked about in that rather gruesome scene. And it's like, it's through Lev, isn't it, that Abby, because Abby's like the mirror of Ellie, isn't he? Like, Ellie is descending into this place where she wants to get vengeance, and Abby is someone who's already been there. She has hit rock bottom. She has achieved her vengeance, and now she feels really shitty about it, and she's trying to kind of, she's got red in her ledger, if you will, and she's trying to erase that. She's trying to redeem herself, and she does that through taking care of Lev and Yara. Like, this is her redemption arc. She's trying to make amends for it all, and I think that's why you love Lev so much. Like, he's her little conscience, and he's the one who stops her from killing Dina as well.
Lev is great.
Oh,
I mean, although they kept referring to Lev and Yara as kids and children, but they didn't look like children to me. They looked like adults to me.
I know, Lev
looks
about
a bit like a kid.
Yeah, he looks about 16 or so, doesn't he?
Not so, but yeah.
Okay. Yeah, Yara seems a little bit older. But it's often hard to tell, I think. Certainly in games, it's not necessarily hard to tell what the age range is in these.
Just as a sort of additional point to your sort of comment about Abby's redemption, which I love. I love how both Abby and Ellie, their fathers guide them to do the right thing in very subtle ways. Like, I think the whole reason Abby goes after Lev is because she has that dream where she sort of sees her father sort of telling her, you know, you gotta go save these people. And in that final fight with Ellie, she has that flash of Joel. Yeah. Telling her, you know, again, guiding her towards the path of redemption. And that's subtle storytelling in the best way. I freaking love that.
Because Abby's arc is essentially Joel's, isn't it? Like, she's become Joel. And that's, and when she's looking after Lev, she has found redemption through looking after, she's basically become Joel. And that's, I think, I'm not sure that Ellie has the, you know, objectivity to see that, but she does see something. but it's a bold move, isn't it? That you see that confrontation at the end of Seattle Day 3, and then you get Abby's whole sequence. And then when we come back to that moment, we come back to that confrontation, and you're not Ellie, you're Abby. You're Abby fighting Ellie. And that's an incredibly bold move in that confrontation.
Yeah. It's a great bit of storytelling, though, just the filling in the gaps, because you're like, okay, now what's the island they mentioned? You know, because they mentioned the island very early on, Abby's gone to the island. And so you're waiting to see what that is. But the story is so much bigger than I expected it to be and takes so many meandering twists and turns. I just thought it was genius because you had no idea how she's going to track them to the cinema. There's so many questions that you're just left with. And I just thought it was brilliant. Like, I was totally engrossed in the whole of Abby's journey, even though I occasionally hated her.
When I tell you that when the perspective shifted, like, criticisms were immediately forming in my brain. This game has pacing issues, cutting from a really intense moment to something else entirely. 4 stars. It was that type of thing. It took me a while to really click with Abby. I think there were two moments that really sold it for me. One where she is very, very high up trying to cross that bridge with Lev.
I love that she's afraid of heights.
To get into the building. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, I'm also afraid of heights, so I empathize with that, believe me. And then the moment that really sold it is when Yara's just been killed, and sort of Lev sort of says, like, you know, your people just killed Yara, and then Abby's like, you're my people. That's a great line. That's a great moment. And that is what really sort of sold me in the connection between those two. And made me want to, you know, I think at that point I was like, crap, I like Abby somehow. Everything that's happened. Yeah. And just really impressive storytelling.
But this is what makes the ending so hard. You've come to love both of these characters, which is an incredible feat to make you do that. I was, if it had ended when Abby lets Ellie go at Lev's request, doesn't kill Dina, lets Ellie go, and Ellie returns to the farm, and you have that beautiful sequence there. And I think it's clear at that point she's got PTSD. When you see her in the barn, when she's having flashes, she has full-on post-traumatic stress. So she can't, it's not a case of her, like, I imagine therapists are in quite short supply in the apocalypse. So she can't continue with her life. Like, she has to carry on with this. She has to see it through, or there will be no peace for her. So you do get that beautiful epilogue in Santa Barbara, which I was very here for, because I was like, yes, more Ellie, more game. Give me all the game. But let's talk about, I mean, that, I would argue that's one of the bleakest parts of it. Just the idea, the slavery of it, the rattlers, all of that. It's nasty.
Yeah, they don't fully, unless I miss stuff, because I wasn't reading all the letters, which is probably, I don't think they fully fleshed out the world of the rattlers what they're doing to people. Do they, like, it's implied? It's implied.
They trade in slaves,
I think there was like a sexual kind of implication to when they were talking about when they catch Ellie. But yeah, they're nasty. They're nasty bastards, definitely. That's established very quickly. But yeah,
they're,
I love that.
They're the only humans you want to kill.
Yeah. And I love the way it lets you kill them in the worst way, where you can set clickers on them by unchaining them. That's like, yes, yeah. Kill them all.
That was very Walking Dead. I think that more than any other part of Last of Us felt, it was kind of like the you know, the governor or whatever. It felt like they were some bad group of Walking Dead characters.
Very much so.
I was just going to say that the post-traumatic stress of, you're talking about earlier, James, with Ellie, I think Abby has that to a much less degree. I think I completely get where you're coming from, Nick, in saying that you wonder if showing Abby so early was not a great move, but from what I remember of that scene, she can't sleep.
Yeah.
And that, you know, again, the similarities between Abby and Ellie are right there, because she can't sleep. She can't get with Owen. She has to kill Joel. Ellie can't sleep, can't stay with Dina. She has to kill Abby. They're just on different stages of the same journey, which I think is really great.
Yeah.
But yeah, the rattlers are the only humans you want to kill, and the fact that they give you a silent submachine gun to do it is awesome.
Game on. Yeah, I was absolutely terrible at that last set piece. I got killed so many times. I was hiding behind barrels. And
can I just say, I completed this in like a weekend. I did the damn thing.
I don't know how you did. How did you do this in a weekend? I do not understand.
I'm good at video games, Nicholas.
Did you just have to curl up in a corner like on Sunday night and just sort of...
Literally, I sort of said in like a week in advance of, to like any family member, I put it on Twitter, like, do not try and contact me, do not try and message me, phone me, email me, all you're going to get is out of office, I'm going to be playing The Last of Us, eating, sleeping, and then playing The Last of Us. That is what I did for like 2 days. It was glorious.
And you read all the letters.
Most of them.
I opened every drawer, I raided every cupboard, I read every letter.
You wrote a few letters, you left them in drawers.
Them, yes.
That'd be amazing if there was a multiplayer where you could write little letters and leave them around.
Corresponding with dead wolves.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, just out of nowhere, I've just remembered what happened to Shimmer the horse.
Oh, Shimmer blown up. Yes. Oh, poor Shimmer. Yeah.
Shot in the head, right?
Well, I think it was an explosion. It's an explosion.
Yeah, but then one of the wolves shoots him in the head.
Yeah, you're right.
That's absolutely right.
But, bloody hell. Yeah, that really hit me as well. I got quite attached to that bloody horse.
Shimmer. Unbelievable. Yeah.
Honestly.
Yeah, a definite step up from Callus, the horse in the first game. But so the ending, that final ending, when Ellie goes down to the beach having killed the shit out of all the rattlers, and you see Abby strung up on that post, she's emaciated, she's hair's all been cut off, like she looks ill, and you wonder what's going to happen there, don't you? Like, is, and because Ellie cuts her down, and then she and Abby has that moment where she looks at Ellie and she's a bit like, what's happening here? And she goes to check on Lev, and then she's like, and she's very tentatively says, oh, there are boats towards the beach, and kind of Ellie doesn't say anything, and you get there, and then Ellie has that moment where she's getting into her own boat and you think she's going to let them go, and she sees that flash of Joel all bloodied and beaten, and she's like, I can't let you go. And it's like, what was going through your mind at that point?
Don't do it. Get in the boat, you idiot.
Ellie, what are you doing?
Get in the boat.
Gosh. The sound design in that scene is so great as well, because when they finally sort of start fighting, there's a big and then they start, and it just, it's like all my heavy feelings were in that sound design with that moment. Is really great. But yeah, you just, at that point, you're just begging Ellie to make the right choice. And when she doesn't, your heart just sinks.
And that's a staggering achievement, right? To get to the climax of a video, get a AAA video game, and have the player begging there not to be action, right? Because that's the whole point of video games. Yeah. You buy them to do the action.
And if you told me that was going to happen sort of 4 hours in when Joel's just been killed, I would have laughed in your face. The fact that you don't want Ellie to kill Abby after the first what happens in the first 2 hours in this game is just incredible.
It is, it's an incredible thing. But I also understand why people found it difficult. And I think, you know, I don't want to generalize too much about the demographic of video game players, but it does require, you know, a willingness to go along with this story that they've read and a willingness to embrace a level of kind of emotional maturity and a level of, I think, of moral ambiguity to kind of reject the fact that there are moral absolutes and to look at this and say, look, everyone is just a person and people are complicated. And you look at this.
Absolutely.
And when she lets Abby go, she makes the right decision. And I think it's a lovely touch that the New Game Plus home screen shows the boat on the beach of Catalina. So clearly Abby has gone to Catalina. She's found the Fireflies and her and Lev have at least continue that way.
What do you think Ellie does in your mind? Do you think she goes to Tommy?
I think she goes back to Jackson, because where else would she go? And I think, Dina's probably there, because where else would she be?
I didn't feel like there was that closeness, because I think there would be a problem with her going back to Jackson, because Tommy is hell-bent on revenge as well, and I do not think Tommy would understand if Ellie said, I found Abby and I didn't kill her. I think that,
but she's been off two of my fingers, so it's all good, and I can't play the guitar anymore.
Yeah, I think Tommy would not accept that. You know, he's given up his marriage. Like, that was a really tragic element of the story as well. That's just kind of bubbling away in the background. You know, even when he gets her that brilliant gift from Seattle, that she's still that marriage is kaput. You know, it's got this festering thing in the middle of it, and it just fell apart. And it's all about this game is all about the corrosive power of anger. If you have that anger inside you, it will melt everything away. It will destroy everything like acid. So I can't see Ellie having a future in Jackson, personally. I think she's going to wander.
I don't think... Yeah, I partially agree with that. I don't think Ellie goes back to Jackson. Whether she has a future there, I would say yes, ultimately, but she needs to do a lot of self-healing before she's ready to sort of go back. Especially the last sort of shot that we see of her is sort of her leaving the guitar. I think she's on the road to closure.
Because she's letting Joel go.
For Joel. Mm. Yeah. But she still needs to wrestle with the decision that Joel made for her and sort of decide, you know, she went from that to finally being in a position to be ready to forgive Joel for that, to now having to go on this quest. She needs to sort of figure out what she wants to do with her life and find purpose again before she's ready to accept Dina and the cutest game kid I've ever seen in my life back Super into cute. Her life. But yeah, now we were talking about sort of how negative or how divisive this game was. And I do get it from this standpoint, in that gaming more often than not is meant to be an escape. This is not really an escape. This is more like a training manual for the next few years, given where we're at right now.
I've already started opening every drawer.
Yeah, yeah. I'm making bombs out of scissors.
What are the scissors? James, I never understood.
I know that you were already ready with like your survival kit. So this is just like, you know.
James has got a backpack stuffed with rags. Yeah.
I always keep alcohol, rags, sugar, explosives on me at all times. And gaffer tape. Lots and lots of tape.
Yeah.
But I get it from that standpoint. Because, you know, this is definitely, you're wrestling with a lot here. And, you know, to dive from, you know, a world which is our world and, you know, messed up as it is, to a world which is even more messed up, I get why people had a hard time with that.
No, I do too. It doesn't shock me. But we get a gift at the end of this, don't we? Like, we get a final flashback. A flashback which actually shouldn't be that surprising. So if you go all the... What we get is we understand that Ellie... Because the flashbacks have been beautiful, because they've not only broken up the pacing, but they've filled out the backstory of what happened between part one and part two. And gradually, and I think that the first switch that it gives you is that idea that she's known all along that he killed the Fireflies. And so... all of this, you think, oh, she has no idea why this has happened. She's looking for answers. She's not looking for answers. She knows exactly why this has happened. She just doesn't give a fuck, and she wants revenge. And the fact that you see that even despite her finding out, even despite her essentially saying her and Joel were through, at the end you see that she had decided to forgive him. She decided to try and forgive him. But obviously, if you go back to the very beginning when she's having that conversation with Dina and she said, what are you doing tonight? She said, I'm going to watch a movie with Joel. So clearly they'd made up anyway. So we should have known that from the start.
Yeah, yeah, that strange like action franchise that you see the poster for occasionally. What was it called?
I can't remember.
Yeah, it's a weird thing. Yeah, they've got sort of imaginary movie posters all the way through these games. Mm. But yeah, they have PlayStation. Yeah. So do they have
PS3s?
Yeah, there's an Uncharted reference in this game as well, right?
There's a copy of Uncharted 2 on the table.
So you have our games in this world, but you have totally different movies, because presumably they can't get the license.
They can license their own games. They can't license other shit.
Right, okay. Maybe Nathan Drake's a real person in this world.
Maybe he is. Well, you get his ring, don't you? His ring is in the bank vault.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Really? That ring, the Latin on it, is the name of the main Uncharted theme.
Which I can never remember, but it's
Signum.
There we go.
So that's what's written on the ring.
Yeah. Greatness from small beginnings.
Yes, good man. Amon drops the Latin bombs.
So Nathan Drake is a real person in this world, so we may team up with him in Last of Us Part 3.
It's canon. It's going to happen.
I think The Last of Us Part 3 should be all about Shimmer's son, the small horse, who is on a mission of revenge.
Wow. I'm taking Warhorse literally. It's funny though, isn't it, that one of the last things they show you is they show you the quite late in the game they show, is it at the very end they show you the dance with Dina and the kiss with Dina? Is it at the very end? It's really late in the game, I know that, and obviously that's the footage that we'd seen before, because that was E3 footage, and we see that quite late. But I think it's nice, because it even though it's quite bleak, it ends with a moment of positivity to it, and it doesn't have that ambiguous ending necessarily that the first one has. There's much more closure, I think, at the end of this one. But did you feel satisfied at the end of it? Did it do it for you? Would you have done anything differently?
I mean, I was definitely satisfied. It's a whole lot of game. Like, it is a lot of game. It took me a day or two to process just how much stuff happens, how much shocking stuff happens, how many emotional twists there are, how many interesting characters there are. I think I texted you quite early on, James, when I was like 3 or 4 hours in. I was like, I'm not sure. The first one was a road trip and it was across America and you had the different seasons, and this one you're just in Seattle and it feels smaller. But I thought they did a brilliant job of making that one location massive, feel massive. And the sky bridges, the sky bridge was totally unexpected. I was like, this is crazy. And I never saw it. But then you do actually, if you're down on the ground and you look up, you can see them between some of the buildings. So they were there all the time. But yeah, I thought it delivered on every level. I mean, the emotional level definitely, but the action level, maybe there could have been a bit more zombie stuff. It feels like the zombies were very sidelined.
Well, you had the Rat King. They had a zombie boss in this one.
This is what I was gonna say. Gosh, that was scary. So if you were to have a camera on me during my first playthrough on that, I think I had a very loud audible, holy shit. And,
I had to turn the brightness way up on my TV to deal with that, because it was too frightening and too dark.
That Rat King sequence gave me newfound appreciation for people in high pressure situations, because I think of Game of Thrones, and that moment where you're trying to get you want the kids to do serpentine and dodge the arrows. I don't know if I'd have the peace of mind to do that now, because the amount of times I died in that Rat King sequence from just losing my shit and just going through all my weapons. What do I do? How do I kill this thing? That was the sweatiest my palms got.
The whole of that hospital was squeaky bum time, wasn't it?
I would say action-wise, definitely the best part of the game was from the skywalk bridge down
through the apartment building.
When you're going down every level, down to the ground, and then you keep going down into the basement across the road and down into the hospital, and it just felt like a descent into hell, because every level gets scarier and scarier. And I did not want to be in the hospital. I was like, guys, go to Superdrug. There's got to be a better option. This is not a good option. Like, to get some bandages, there's got to be a better way.
Surely you know? There's a boots that's closer that you could have just got
something from. Honestly,
that's amazing. Weirdly, my favourite sequence in the whole game, I honestly think, is one of the flashbacks, the museum sequence, when Joel and Ellie go to the museum and there's no action of any kind. He just goes there. They have those wonderful gags where, brilliantly written, where they're riffing on Jurassic Park and how Steven Spielberg changed the names of the velociraptors. And then he's like, oh yeah, there was a sequel. Wasn't as good. And it's just like, it's beautiful moments. Putting her hat on the different dinosaurs. And then when you have that beautiful moment when they get in the space and she relives the launch of the rocket. And it's just beautiful Joel Ellie bonding time, and it really cements the relationship between those two. And I think it's a massive credit to Naughty Dog that sequence, which has no action, it's just two characters wandering around a museum and chatting to each other, which sounds so mundane, is so engaging.
It's magical, yeah. It has the great line, "What does it smell like in the space?" when she's in the shuttle. And originally, I don't know if Trotman mentioned this, but originally there was there was an action scene in there. We know when the boar kind of runs at her. Yeah. Originally, you were going to have to like chase down the boar and kill it. And he said, you know, we actually animated it and then decided it slowed everything down. But you don't need it. You don't need the action. It's just brilliant. It's the mood change from this magical thing to seeing the writing on the wall and it getting sinister. Darker and darker. It's
and
great.
Then seeing it that it was a firefly anything, who'd written it, like that's quite poignant as well. It's it's very well thought through.
There's quite a lot of stuffed animals in this game.
There's a lot of taxidermy.
There's a lot of taxidermy. Yeah, yeah. Last one standing.
I feel like this is as good a time as any to talk about Ashley Johnson and Laura Bailey and Troy Baker and Shannon Woodward and just how fantastic these guys are. And, you know, it bothers me anytime I see sort of, you know, death threats and what have you and, you know, actors being subjected to that. But even more so in this case, because I've sort of watched interviews with these guys and you think that we're attached to these characters. We're not attached to these characters on the same level that Ashley Johnson and Troy Baker and Laura Bailey are. And, you know, they put their all into these performances and it really, really shows. Like, even in that final flashback we get with Ellie and Joel, the choice of restraint there, because I think I've read in sort of other interviews how initially that was meant to end with a hug and they're meant to be more emotional, but, you know, the actors decided actually, no, it shouldn't be that way. And it sort of plays better because of it. There's so many little choices like that, which, you know, you only get from knowing how to collaborate with these amazing performers, and you know, they do an incredible job.
And the acting is extraordinary. Like, it's absolutely like big screen level performances.
Yeah, like you were saying, James, the fact that they actually, the actors get to have input into the lines, the dialogue, the moments. I mean, it definitely transcends what you think of when you think of video game performances. I would watch a very long documentary about the making of this. I'd be fascinated. Did you guys see the image of how they did the Rat King, where they tied three people together? And for the mocap, have a look at Google it because it's fascinating. They tied three dudes together. One of them is upside down, and they're all tied together, like running around this room with gym mats. And it's even that is frightening.
Yeah, it is nice. You know, like Ashley Johnson. You remember Ashley Johnson was in Avengers? She was in the Avengers. But she was going to be Cap's love interest in future films. Like, she was being teed up for that, and in the end, they used Emily Van Camp. She was going to have a larger role in those. But she is so fucking good in this. All of that. Troy Baker is amazing in this, and Shannon Woodward, Laura Bailey as well. Just incredible performances across the board. And I think, you know, it's tribute in part to the quality of the reproduction of these characters and the skill that the developers have done in making it and the performances, those two things working together to give you these incredibly believable characters that are entirely within this game engine. It's nuts. But right, before we wrap up, is there anything else anyone wishes to say? Amon, are you going to whip out a guitar and give us a brief a brief ditty for us?
You should be so lucky, James. No, but I will say the score by Gustavo Santolalla and Mac Whale is fantastic. It is. And you know, I was reading sort of an interview with Gustavo, and he was talking about his process. And maybe it's because I got... first of all, I'll say he said that in his process, he starts scoring before sort of, you know, seeing anything. He scores, and his music informs the script rather than the script sort of informing the music. And it really shows. And it reminds me of sort of the, you know, now side of the departed and Ennio Morricone, who had the same sort of process. And when you collaborate with people who know how to use that in the edit or in this case, you know, in the game, it really shines through. So there's a few parts where it's just it's, the scenes are almost driven by music. And in those moments, it's just great.
And some of the scenes are quite literally driven by music, like the prologue where Joel gifts Ellie the guitar, and you get that lovely moment in the music shop where she plays Aha to Dina on the guitar as well. Like, music is a real thread through this. It's like part of the fabric of the game. It's
No Stairway. That's a Wayne's World reference.
No Stairway to Heaven. There was a sign on the wall when she was playing then, if you saw it.
And James, you have purchased a guitar and are learning to play guitar based on this
true.
Game.
Like, see, the music in this game, the guitar playing in this game is such a part of it. It really made me want to play the guitar. So I literally went out and bought a guitar on the strength of playing it in this game just to tinker with it. It was...
See, you can't say that now and now not sort of go grab
I'm definitely
guitar
not
and
playing
play something
on this podcast. Nobody needs an outro.
Sing us out. Were to lose you,
I will
actually lose myself.
I will one day work up to that, but I'm not there yet. I know about 5 chords. I don't think I can quite bust that out. But yeah, like, both Baker and Johnson played guitar on stage during that One Night Live thing, because they're both good guitar players. But good stuff. The music is amazing. Right, are we all done?
My parting thought is just that this has put me off whistling for life. I was walking through a forest yesterday and I heard someone whistling for their dog, and I genuinely thought it was a scar.
Not an arrow
and
was coming frightened. Your way.
Yeah, I genuinely ducked down and
did you
scurried
brutally
into a nearby
them?
Hedge. yes, well, let's not talk about that one, yeah. But no, it's amazing and I cannot wait to play it again. And this time I'm going to read the letters, I promise.
It is a magnificent game.
And open all the vaults.
Open all the safes.
I gave up on the safes quite early on.
I got all the safes. Right, with that, I think we are, in fact, done with this extra special spoiler special for The Last of Us Part 2. If you enjoyed it, then do head over to glow.fm/empirefilm and subscribe to the Empire Spoiler Special podcast, where you will find even more exciting in-depth podcasts. Recent ones we've done include our multi-part Gangs of London spoiler specials with Corin Hardy and Gareth Evans, our retro spoiler special for Jack Reacher with Chris McQuarrie. We've done a John Wick retro recently with Chad Stahelski. There's a King of Staten Island discussion with Judd Apatow, and we also have one for Hamilton coming up very soon as well. The regular Empire podcast drops every Friday with all the latest news, reviews, and general movie nonsense. And if it's small screen recommendations you're after, then the Pilot TV podcast is available for your listening pleasure every Monday as well. In the meantime, though, it is goodbye from Nick DeSemlin.
May your survival be long. May your death be swift.
It is goodbye from Amon Woman.
Peace.
And it is goodbye from me. I'm off to bust out a maudlin rendition of Take On Me on my guitar.